This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do Walmart and Michelle Obama have in common? As it turns out, more than you might think. How computer games can help save the planet and the recession economics of the mob. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 20th of January. Good to have you with us. Yes, Walmart and Michelle Obama, that is where we begin the broadcast today. The First Lady and the First Retailer teamed up this morning for an announcement about healthy food. Walmart, which is also this country's biggest grocer, said it's going to put a lot more foods that are lower in ingredients like fat and salt on its shelves by the year 2015. The company also said it's going to squeeze costs out of the supply chain to bring down sticker prices for fresh fruits and vegetables. A lot of companies have been getting on the healthy choices bandwagon of late, but Walmart and the White House might actually be able to change things. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The folks at the Center for Science and the Public Interest, sometimes called the Food Police, are often skeptical when big companies claim to get religion on nutrition. Not this time, though. Executive Director Michael Jacobson.
Traditionally, supermarkets have been very neutral, and it's great that a supermarket chain is using its marketplace muscle to encourage its suppliers to provide healthier foods.
Of course, Walmart isn't just any supermarket. 140 million Americans walk through its doors every week. If reducing fat, sugar, and salt is the price of being at Walmart, companies like Kraft and General Mills are likely to comply. They'll have no choice. But consumers do have a choice. Market researcher Harry Balzer at the NPD Group says Americans actually have a history of walking away from healthier foods after the initial fad wears off.
I've seen major companies make initiatives to provide Americans with healthier products, and it doesn't seem like it always works. We haven't gotten healthier.
Balzer says consumers won't buy these lower whatever products just because Walmart pushes them.
In the end, if you can make health easier or cheaper than what I pay for food right now, we will go there.
Which explains Walmart's other new initiative, lower prices. The chain says it'll take $1 billion a year off the cost of fresh fruits and vegetables. Bruce Babcock is an agricultural economist at Iowa State, and he says Walmart can do this without shortchanging farmers on their apples and broccoli.
They will likely be able to offer farmers a price that may be lower than the competition, but the farmer's better off because it's such a large volume and the reliability and the timing is just perfect.
These announcements are also perfect timing for Walmart. It's trying to expand in urban areas and faces opposition from unions and neighborhood activists. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's blame aplenty to share when it comes to the financial crisis. The big credit rating firms have come in for some of the most severe criticism, complaints that S&P and Fitch and Moody's didn't just miss the subprime meltdown, they were active participants in it. Thanks to the fact that this is a capitalist economy, there's a new entry in the ratings game today, one that is promising to tell bond investors exactly how much risk they are getting themselves into. Our senior business correspondent Bob Mouton reports.
Jules Kroll built a reputation doing investigations for big companies. Now he's hoping his respected name will help restore investor confidence in the bond rating system. He's vowing to deliver what he calls deep, due diligence.
I would refer to it as more thorough.
But skeptics are asking how thorough this newcomer to credit ratings can be following the same business model as the so-called Big Three, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. Like them, Kroll will be paid not by investors but by the banks and institutions selling the bonds. At the boutique ratings firm Egan Jones, Sean Egan says that creates a conflict of interest.
You don't know if the rating that was assigned was because of financial benefit or if they truly believe that that is a correct rating.
The research Egan's firm does is paid for by investors. Kroll argues his own name and reputation are at stake, but at L.A.-based Envision Capital Management, money manager Marilyn Cohen wonders why people selling debt would invite a tougher rating, given that they can shop around for a favorable one.
I hate to be such a skeptic, but it's hard to believe it's going to last long. I think he has very good intentions. It's the same business model. Tell me what's different here.
Kroll remains convinced, though, that there's a market for more credible ratings.
It'll have to be people that are confident that they feel that our name will be something very different and mean something different to investors that will be useful to them in selling their wares.
Kroll argues that most investors don't want to pay for research. They just want to be able to trust what the ratings agency says, and he aims to restore that faith. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Topping the charts in the music business used to mean something back in the day. Not so much, really, anymore. This week, the number one Billboard spot goes to an album by the alternative rock band Cake, having sold just 44,000 copies. That is the saddest showing ever for a number one album, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
After taking a six-year break, the band Cake produced its latest album, Showroom of Compassion, in its own solar-powered studio. It released the record on its own label, and it shot to the top of the charts.
I'm so sick of you, so sick of me. I don't want to be with you.
And that's a bad sign for big labels. Mark Mulligan is an analyst with Forrester Research in Britain. He says these record-breakingly bad sales figures are just the latest sign this industry is dying.
People are listening to more music now across more platforms and devices than at any stage previously. What has changed is that people aren't paying for it in the way that they used to.
CD sales have collapsed, and actual sales of digital music only rose 7% globally last year. Mulligan says there are just too many other ways to listen, from digital piracy to legitimate sites like Pandora or YouTube. And if you really have to own Britney Spears' latest single, you can join the nearly 500,000 people who downloaded it last week and skip her album.
Would you hold it?
The answer is probably yes, at least if you're an executive in the music business. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
I don't know. I'd say Steve probably actually bought that album. I don't know. Anyway, Google made buckets of money in the fourth quarter, but that's not the real G news of the day. Eric Schmidt is all done. He's stepping down as CEO. He's going to remain an advisor and executive chairman. Co-founder Larry Page is going to take over. Overall, Wall Street couldn't quite cut it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so consider this the next time you hear a story about video games, about people spending countless hours gunning down bad guys or fending off aliens. Jane McGonigal says all the energy and creativity that we as a society spend gaming online might actually be able to help save the world. And I say that without too much exaggeration. Her new book about gaming and the promise it holds is called Reality is Broken.
What seems to me to be totally broken about reality is the difference between how we feel when we're playing our favorite games and how we feel in real life. When we're playing our favorite games, we feel like we are on a journey. We have a heroic purpose, and we are ready to rise to the occasion. And in our real lives, we just don't have the sense that we can do something that matters, that we can have that impact, that we have the collaborators. And I'm really just looking for ways to take that incredible structure of games that put us on the path to save the world and bring it into the real world.
So give me an example. You did this one called World Without Oil, which does seem to be kind of a macro, a very large scale problem.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, we developed that game in 2007, And we had this crazy scenario. What if gas prices were over $4 a gallon? And at the time, this seemed like a really futuristic scenario.
And lo and behold,
a year later, it actually came to pass. But what we did was we asked people to just try and live their real lives for 6 weeks as if this were a real oil shortage, a real gas crisis, and to see what they could come up with creatively to get to work differently, to feed their family differently, to have a social life differently. We created a game and we made it a collaborative adventure, and somehow that made it not stressful and not boring. It made it adventurous and a challenge.
Let me try to pin you down a little bit. We are spending these hours, these tens of thousands of hours gamers are in these games developing all these skills, but what are they really good at? I mean, what can gamers do?
So the first thing, and I think this is the most important one when it comes to solving real world problems, is they have an incredible resilience in the face of difficult challenges. So gamers spend 80% of their time failing in game worlds. They are not completing the mission. They're not leveling up. They didn't find the loot that they were looking for. And this is really remarkable. In real life, if we were spending 80% of our time failing at something, we would quit and go home. We would think we were bad, and that would not be any fun. But gamers have this ability to keep their eye on a really ambitious goal. The other one that is really important is this idea of extreme scale collaboration. You know, increasingly people are spending time playing multiplayer and massively multiplayer games. And when you do that, you start to develop what I call collaboration radar. You're always looking out for what other people are good at, what their strengths are, what they can bring to the team. And that ability to organize large groups of people where everybody gets to contribute their skill, their strength, is really important as we start to tackle planetary scale problems. We're going to need a lot of people, and we're going to need to find something for everyone to do.
You know, I was thinking about that because I watched a video of you as I was getting ready for this interview. You gave a TED Talk, and I was thinking as I was watching that the flaw in the logic, and I agree with a lot of your theory, but the flaw in the logic is that there's no downside in a game. If you mess up in a game, you die, but you regenerate, right? If you mess up in real life, you lose your house, you don't get to go to college or whatever, right?
Right, yeah. That's totally true, which is why the kind of state of the art of alternate reality game design now is figuring out what is that right match between gamers who still need to be able to fail safely and real-world problems. So it's not about taking crazy risks and leaping off buildings and, you know, quitting your job, but it's about finding what are small things that ordinary people can do that when you combine them in a game, it turns out to be extraordinary.
Jane McGonigal is at the Institute for the Future up in Palo Alto, California. She's also got a new book out. It's called Reality is Broken. There's an excerpt of it at our website on our book blog. It's called The Big Book. It's at marketplace.org/thebigbook. Jane, thanks a lot.
It was great to talk to you.
Chinese President Hu Jintao is on the move today. After lunch on Capitol Hill, he's having dinner in Chicago with the mayor and the governor of Illinois. Back home, meanwhile, Hu's countrymen are gearing up for what can only be called an epic travel challenge. The Lunar New Year is approaching, and over the next couple of weeks, the Chinese will make an estimated 2.5 billion passenger trips. Train stations are beyond packed, as our China correspondent Rob Schmitz found out.
For the Chinese, New Year's is a time of reevaluating your life, where you've been, where you're going, and where you're staying put. There's little else to think about while you're standing motionless in line with hundreds of thousands of others for 2 straight days just to get a train ticket. Just ask Wang Dongho.
I got here last night about 24 hours ago. It'll be another day before I get a chance to buy a ticket. Even then, I'm not sure I'll get one.
A megaphone on a police car belts out a looped recording warning people to stay away from scalpers. Wang's greatest hope is that by this time tomorrow, he'll have a ticket that'll let him stand, wedged between other migrants, on a 36-hour train trip back home to Sichuan Province so he can see his son. Wang's 39. He assembles furniture at a warehouse for $500 a month. Half of that goes to rent for a bed in a crowded room, the other half to his family. But lately, he's set more aside to cover the rising cost of food. Rapid inflation makes him wonder how he can go on.
I can't stay in Shanghai long term on such a low salary. I've been talking to a colleague about starting our own business making furniture, but who knows how that'll turn out. I really want to stay here. In the end, Shanghai'll dump me before I dump her.
Further back in line, Yuan Shiping's found his own way of dumping Shanghai. He's making the break with some help from a bottle of 120-proof Baijiu, rice liquor.
The price for everything is going up, and my salary stayed the same. This year I've lost a lot of money living here.
The 45-year-old construction worker poses a question. Why live in a crowded room in a crowded city when he's got a house on a farm back in Sichuan? Yuan takes another swig of his baijiu, wipes his lip, and announces to his friends he's had it with Shanghai.
These days, a lot of us aren't crazy about living in Shanghai. Why live so far away from our families when we can get a decent job back home? Things in our hometown have improved, so this time I plan to stay there for good.
Yuan's friends stare at the ground, smirking. They've heard this before, and they'll hear it again on the two-day trip back home. And after New Year's is over, they'll most likely hear it yet again on their return trip back to Shanghai. At Shanghai's railway station, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's more about Rob's jaunt down to the train station on his blog. Pictures of very long lines as well. It's all on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, healthcare India style.
This is a 1,000-bed heart hospital. We do about 33 to 35 heart surgeries a day.
And it's cheap, too. But first, we got to do the numbers. The Dow Industrials barely budged today. It dipped just 2 points, less than a 0.1%, closed at 11,822. The NASDAQ fell 0.75%, 21 points, 2704 at the bell. The S&P 500 backed up a 0.1%. That's about a point. Ended things at 1280. Financial firms had a mostly good day. Morgan Stanley pushed up 4.5% on stronger than expected profits. JP Morgan Chase ticked up 2.33% on this Thursday. Bank of America deposited more than 1%. After the big announcement, rather before the big announcement, Google shares reversed 0.75% in regular trading. The announcement came after the bell. Walmart's announcement that it's going to sell healthier foods improved the stock's health. Shares up about 1.75%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.45%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. By LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. And by Reputation.com, protecting and improving your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The annual winter meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors wraps up in Washington. A visit to the White House is on tomorrow's agenda. The curtain goes up on the Slam Dance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. And I'd say participation in this is optional. It's National Hugging Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back. This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The FBI did what you can only call a sweep in New York this morning. The feds arrested 127 members of the families that control the mafia throughout New York, New Jersey, and New England. And if the mob were a company, in a way it kind of is, that would really affect the bottom line in an already weak economy. So we've called Greg Smith. He covers organized crime for the New York Daily News. Greg, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be here.
Is there a way to figure out how big the mob economy is in the New York area?
Yeah, it's difficult to quantify because these guys don't really file 10Q statements to the SEC. However, there are certain aspects of the mafia that are extremely predictable. One of them is their infiltration of unions. That's always been their big moneymaker because when they can control a union, they can extort a lot of money out of big business. And that is the thing that goes up and down with the economy for them. They always have their other scams as well, but that's the big money maker for them.
The two industries that were mentioned a lot in news reports about the arrest this morning were construction and then the New York City waterfront.
Yes, that's correct. There were three unions that were implicated in today's massive arrest. The waterfront union, which is, I guess, not terribly surprising. The mafia has been involved in the New York, New Jersey waterfront forever. Today's indictment basically goes after the New Jersey side. Then there's the Concrete Workers Union, another non-surprise because they've been involved in the construction industry also forever. And then the other one is the Teamsters.
The recession obviously has affected the entire economy. Can you figure out how the recession has treated the mob?
Well, they react the way everybody reacts to the economy. If the money's not coming in from one place, they go try to find it somewhere else. One of the things that I saw fairly recently was they showed up in some of these mortgage fraud schemes that are kind of a reaction to the collapse of the housing market. So while they made some good money during the housing run-up by controlling, for example, construction unions, they're also controlling certain corrupt contractors that were, you know, making a lot of money when the housing market was on the way up. When the thing collapsed, they then switched over and got into mortgage fraud, which is also apparently quite a lucrative way of making money.
Yeah, that's a fact. The mob obviously is cyclical, right? I mean, some families are up, some are down. Business is good, business is bad. Is there any reason to think that this is some kind of nail in the coffin?
No, I mean, the mafia in America, and specifically in New York, has been pronounced dead repeatedly. But these guys are really resilient. You know, they just find new ways to get money. You know, no matter what the status of the economy is, no matter what the status of the FBI is, they're always around.
Greg Smith, he's a reporter at the New York Daily News. His book is called Nothing But Money, How the Mob Infiltrated Wall Street. Greg, thanks a lot.
No problem. Thank you.
You can see how much you know about the business of the mob at our news quiz on our website. It's marketplace.org. In the House of Representatives today, the Republicans plan to change the health care law was farmed out to four separate committees, hearings and more debate to follow in the months to come. But while Congress and the rest of the country continue to argue over who's helped and who's hurt by the health care reform, the world's cheapest health insurance program can be found in India. It covers at least 4 million of that country's poorest farmers with a fairly simple philosophy. More patients means lower costs. From Bangalore, WAMU's Kavita Cardoza has the story.
Dr. Devi Shetty is well known across India. After all, he was the cardiac surgeon for Mother Teresa. Today, his patient is a 5-year-old with a hole in her heart.
What's your name?
My name is Parvati.
As her little legs dangle from her chair, Shetty uses a model of the heart to explain the girl's condition to her parents.
This is the main valve called aortic valve. The hole is very close to the valve.
Shetty and his team of 40 cardiac surgeons at Narayana Hrudalaya Hospital are used to conversations like this one. They perform many more operations each year than comparable US hospitals.
This is a 1,000-bed heart hospital. We do about 33 to 35 heart surgeries a day.
About a third of all the patients at Shetty's hospital are farmers from rural villages. They're here because they have something called Yeshawini insurance. It doesn't cover routine doctor's visits for, say, a cough or a cold, but the insurance does cover all surgical procedures. The farmer pays approximately 3 cents a month, the government puts in 1.5 cents, and farmers' cooperatives operate the program. Shetty believes there's strength in numbers.
There may be 10,000 people living in a village. Individually, they may not be able to afford even a bicycle. But all of them together, they can buy a Mercedes car. They may not be able to sit inside the car at one time, but when their daughters get married, they can always sit in the car and go for the wedding.
That volume actually allows them to negotiate really good deals, lower costs of medical equipment and drugs. And the success rate for surgery at Shetty's hospital is as good as hospitals in the US at a fraction of the cost. Shivananda is a 27-year-old farmer. A telltale scar runs down his chest. He's recovering from heart surgery. Instead of private rooms with a flat-screen TV and kitchenette, Nanda is in a general ward with 9 other patients. He makes less than $200 a year. How would he have paid for surgery without this insurance? Tears run down his face.
He's crying.
Nanda's cousin, Suresh Helanth, steps in to answer what he's too upset to say.
I don't want to think about it.
Typically, farmers have to sell their land, take out crippling loans, or just not have the surgery. That's why Yeshwini Insurance is immensely popular. Farmers can choose from any one of 350 hospitals in the region. Dr. Julius Punan is a cardiac surgeon who helped set up the program. He says every day the hospital battles with private insurance companies to get reimbursed. But Yeshwini is different. It was designed to provide treatment. Punan says he was asked to conduct a cardiac screening camp in his own hometown, where the insurance program doesn't exist.
I said, yes, I can do it, but you have to tell me, what do I do with the people whom I diagnosed to have a disease? It's always the same answer. You cannot pay for it, and I don't have a solution for it. Here I have a solution.
Today, every state in India is starting a similar program. But even though it costs just a few pennies a month, Shetty says it still took farmers some convincing that the money was worth it.
When you tell them that you pay 5 rupees per month and if you ever need a heart operation or a brain operation, you can get it done free, they're very happy. But they ask a question, okay, if I don't have the operation at the end of the year, will you return my 5 rupees?
No, that's not how insurance works, no matter where you are in the world. In Bangalore, I'm Kavita Cardoza for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals, on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the curious case of the missing carbon permits. Europe, as you may know, has an emissions market. Cap and trade is the term. The whole thing revolves around permits that companies can buy and sell that let them generate more greenhouse gases should they have a need to. Anyway, the European carbon market was closed today for at least a week because computer hackers have stolen $36 million worth of those permits. They're traded electronically. Before things were brought to a halt, the right to put 1 metric ton of carbon into the atmosphere was going for 14.5 euros. It's about 20 bucks American. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow barely budged, dipped just 2 points, far less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ fell 0.75%, 21 points. The S&P 500 backed up at 0.1%, about a point. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, it is arguably the strongest economy in the Western world. Arguably.
We are not living in a wonderland in Germany. We have also a lot of things to improve.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.